Chapter 68. Stranglers. The word strangler has a brutal ring, like slasher and ripper. It conveys an idea of physical violence, and this is no linguistic accident. In fact, most stranglers have been violent, brutal men. The act of strangling suggests a deliberate savagery. A man who kills with a gun wants to get it over with as quickly as possible, and a man who kills with a knife may be possessed by a vindictive fury, his basic aim being to destroy, to extinguish the spark of life. But the strangler is a man who takes pleasure in close contact with his victim. It takes several minutes to kill someone by strangulation, and during that time the strangler holds the choice of life or death. By simply relaxing his grip, he can allow the victim to breathe again. And so strangling is a more willful and deliberate form of murder than most, and it's never free from a touch of sadism. It's therefore not surprising that in the great majority of cases, stranglers are motivated by sex. Christie, the rapist of Notting Hill, chose to strangle his victims after he had rendered them unconscious with a coal gas inhaler and then stripped and assaulted them. It would have been just as simple to have smothered them with a pillow or even to gas them. He preferred strangulation because it was another form of rape. Earl Nelson, the guerrilla murderer, strangled and outraged 22 women during his incredible career of murder in North America and Canada. The word outraged here has a certain frightful accuracy, since he tore open some of the bodies with his bare hands. Peter Curtin, the Dusseldorf sadist, often grabbed women in dark streets and throttled them until he achieved a sexual climax. If he achieved the climax while the victim was still alive, he left her. And strangely enough, some girls who went out with him more than once actually allowed him to throttle them as they had intercourse. Curtin told one who protested, "That's what love's all about." It follows then that female killers seldom commit murder by strangulation. The very few cases that are known involve highly dominant women, and the sexual motif is usually present somewhere. There was Nina Housden, who lived near Detroit, a passionate, violent and neurotic woman who was pathologically jealous of her bus driver husband, Charles. In 1947, he left her. Just before Christmas that year, she invited him over for a drink for old time's sake, got him drunk, then strangled him with a clothesline. The next day, she dismembered him and wrapped the parts of the body in newspaper. But from then on, luck was against her. She set out with the parts of the body in the car, intending to dispose of them in the Kentucky hills. The car broke down in Toledo, Ohio, and the garage proprietor was surprised when the woman said that she would wait in the car, even if it took a week to repair. A garage mechanic looked into one of the evil-smelling parcels on the back seat while Nina slept and discovered a human leg. She was sentenced to life imprisonment. Then there was Mrs. Stilo Cristofi, who strangled her daughter-in-law, stripped her naked, and tried to burn the body on a bonfire in the backyard of her Hampstead home in London. The motive was sexual jealousy of her son's wife, and this is underlined by the stripping of the body. Perhaps the most pathetic case of a female strangler was the Scotswoman Susan Newell, who in June of 1923 strangled the 13-year-old boy who brought her newspapers. Her husband had deserted her, and she was living alone. The following morning, together with her 8-year-old daughter, Janet, Mrs. Newell took the body to Glasgow in a go-kart. As she climbed out of a lorry that had given her a lift, the cart slipped, and a head and a foot protruded from the wrapped bundle inside it. A woman who saw this from an upstairs window called the police. Mrs. Newell was found guilty, and in due course she was hanged. A psychiatrist had declared that she was not insane. It seems probable that the motive for the crime was sexual. Sex-starved women have often been known to approach young boys. He may have struggled or threatened to tell, and she strangled him. There's no complex Freudian reason for this association of strangling with sex. It's simply that, of all forms of killing, strangulation is the one that most directly expresses resentment. And as police officers know, there's usually some sexual motive concealed in a strangling case, even if it's not at once apparent. For example, when the strangled body of 35-year-old John Moody was found in a chalk pit near Woldingham in Surrey, the police were at first inclined to believe the motive was robbery. Letters in the victim's room led them to Thomas Lay, ex-Minister of Justice for New South Wales, Australia, and to John Smith, a foreman builder who had been hired by Lay to help murder John Moody. It eventually transpired that Lay had been insanely jealous of Moody, believing that he was the lover of Lay's ex-mistress, Mrs. Maggie Brooke. The belief had no foundation whatsoever, but when Lay succeeded in luring Moody to his house in Kensington, he administered a brutal beating and then strangled him. Even in the case of the death of a woman, the sexual motive may not at once be apparent. When the body of 21-year-old Mary Moonan was found in a driveway in a fashionable quarter of Minneapolis in April of 1955, there was at first nothing to suggest a sexual attack. Her red coat, black skirt and white blouse were untorn, and the skirt had been pulled well down over her thighs. Her underwear was apparently undisturbed. The autopsy revealed no sexual attack. A handbag underneath the body contained $5, so the motive was clearly not robbery. But Mrs. Moonan had certainly been strangled, and had had intercourse not long before her death. At her home in East 17th Street, the police discovered that she was the mother of a 9-month-old daughter, and that she was living with her father, an elderly retired man in poor health. Her husband was in the army in Korea. This offered the police their first real lead, for Matthias Moonan had been overseas for 6 months, and Mrs. Moonan was found to be 3 months pregnant. Who, then, was her lover? Here they seemed to encounter a dead end. Her father seemed certain that she had no lover. She was a good Catholic, deeply in love with her husband, devoted to the baby. She was a regular churchgoer. It seemed impossible that she could be having a secret affair. The police questioned the victim's sister, Mrs. Donald Newton, a pretty girl in her mid-twenties. At first, she could provide no clue. And then, when the police told her that her sister had mentioned a dental appointment on the day of the murder, Mrs. Newton looked thoughtful. She was able to tell them the name of Mary's dentist. It was Dr. Arnold Asher Axelrod. He was a well-known figure in Minneapolis, having served as mayor during the war, and since then taken an active part in civic affairs. He had once been Mrs. Newton's dentist, but she had walked out one day and never gone back. Why? Because Axelrod had given her a pill that had knocked her out for 6 hours, and when she had woken up, he had talked suggestively, and on a later occasion he had made a pass at her. But that had not prevented her recommending Axelrod to her sister when she needed a dentist. And the sister knew that Axelrod had given Mary the same knockout pill on a number of occasions, and had to drive her home afterwards. When the police called on Mary Moonan's doctor, the case suddenly began to simplify. The doctor told them that Mary claimed Axelrod was the father of the unborn child. He had given her a pill that made her groggy, laid her on the couch, and had had sexual intercourse with her. Dr. Axelrod, a middle-aged man with dark hair and a dark moustache, was brought in for questioning, and quickly admitted killing Mary Moonan. He claimed that she had often visited him, and accused him of being the father of the child, which he denied. On the day of the murder, she had again accused him of fathering the child. He had asked her to wait for him in his car, and then driven off with her. She threatened that she would expose him, and then, said Axelrod, he blacked out. And when he came to, he was alone in the car. "I guess I did it," said Axelrod, sighing. "No one else was there." The police now discovered that they had already had a complaint against Axelrod on file. 3 weeks before the murder, a 17-year-old schoolgirl had called at his surgery for treatment. He had given her a pill, and when she woke up 6 hours later, Axelrod was sitting beside her. She had no idea whether an assault had taken place, but she was angry at being kept in his office until the early hours of the morning. Axelrod drove her home, and she had reported the matter by phone. The police found that Axelrod seemed to prefer female patients. He had few males on his books, and at least 20 women told of being put to sleep with a knockout pill and waking many hours later lying on the couch. Newspapers talked openly of Axelrod's love pills, the laws of libel being less stringent in America than in Europe. The prosecutor at his trial described him as an amorous philanderer, who drugged his pretty victims so they could not resist his sexual advances. The defence confined itself to trying to show that the police had not proved their case against Axelrod. For example, the victim's clothes had not been properly examined, but had been left in a damp morgue for 5 months. They also called a surprise witness, the victim's brother-in-law, Donald Newton. Newton was serving a 3-month sentence for indecent exposure, and had told a cellmate that he could crack the case wide open. However, he only added to the confusion. When asked whether he had been at work on the evening of the murder, he replied that he must decline to answer the question because it might incriminate me. This naturally gave rise to speculation about whether he meant that he had some connection with the murder, although on balance it seems more likely that he was referring to the crime for which he was serving a sentence. Another witness, a taxi driver, declared that he had seen Mrs. Moonan get out of Axelrod's car and drive off with two men. But the jury remained unconvinced. They found Axelrod guilty of manslaughter, and he was sentenced to between 5 and 20 years in the state prison. This final ambiguity about the Axelrod case is characteristic of many strangulation murders. When a man seizes a woman by the throat, his intentions may only be to silence her. Alternatively, he may be expressing some aggressive impulse that intends to stop short of murder. This means that in many cases, the real solution should perhaps be in the hands of a psychologist rather than a policeman. The case of Frederick Field may be taken as a typical example. On October the 2nd, 1931, the almost naked body of a young woman was found in an empty shop in Shaftesbury Avenue in London. She had been strangled. It didn't take the police long to identify her as a prostitute, 20-year-old Nora Upchurch, who was well known in the area. Suspicion quickly came to rest on the man who had the keys to the empty shop, an electrician, Frederick Field, who claimed that he had given them to a man who wanted to rent the shop. The police could establish no obvious motive for the crime. Why should anyone kill a prostitute for sex? So, although both the police and the coroner were convinced that Field was lying, a verdict of murder by persons unknown was returned. On the whole, robbery seemed the likeliest motive. In 1933, Field, now in the Royal Air Force, walked into a newspaper office and said that he wanted to confess to the murder of Nora Upchurch. It soon became clear that if Field was guilty, his confession was basically false. For example, he said that he had strangled the girl with his hands, but she had been strangled with a belt. It seemed likely that he had confessed to get money out of the newspaper, which had treated his story as an exclusive and had talked to him for hours before informing the police. Field went on trial and now withdrew his confession, saying that he made it only because he was fed up and he was having trouble with his wife. The judge instructed the jury to find him not guilty. And then in April 1936, the body of a prostitute was found in her room in Clapham. She had been suffocated. She was identified as Mrs. Beatrice Vilna Sutton, but no one had seen her with her killer. That evening, Frederick Field, who had deserted from his unit, called on a girlfriend and told her mysteriously that she would soon read something interesting in the newspapers. The girl's mother, thinking that Field looked insane, telephoned the police. The deserter was arrested, and at the police station he suddenly confessed to the murder of Mrs. Sutton. His description of her room was circumstantial, and nothing had yet appeared in the newspapers. At his trial, Field tried the same trick as before, repudiating his confession, declaring that he had made it because he was fed up. But it was obvious that this time he knew too much about the crime to be innocent. The jury found him guilty, and he was sentenced to death. Police suspected that he may have been responsible for the murder of at least 4 other prostitutes in the Soho area. The Lucy Berlin murder investigation, which took place in 1904, certainly deserves a high place among epics of forensic detection. Lucy Berlin was a 9-year-old girl, well developed for her age, who lived in a slum tenement in Berlin. On June the 11th, 1904, a boatman on the River Spree saw a bundle floating in the river, and he pulled it out. It contained the headless and limbless torso of a child, who was soon identified as Lucy Berlin, who had been missing for 2 days. It was definitely a sex murder. The child had been raped, and her parents declared that she had been told repeatedly never to go off with a strange man. This led the investigators to wonder if she had been killed in the slum tenement at 130 Ackerstrasse. They questioned all the other tenants. On the floor above Lucy's parents lived a prostitute named Johanna Liebenstrut. A man who was also in her room identified himself as Theodor Berger and gave another address. It was only later that the police discovered that Johanna had been in prison for 3 days for insulting a client at the time of the murder, and that Berger, her lover and pimp, had lived in her room during that time. They also learned that Berger was proposing to marry Johanna, which caused some remark among their neighbours, since he had been steadfastly refusing for the past 18 years. More parcels, containing the missing head, the arms and legs, were found in the ship canal. Berger was taken to view these remains, but he continued to insist that he knew nothing about the child's death. Johanna Liebenstrut was taken to police headquarters and questioned. She had nothing to hide, and she was even frank about the reason that Berger had finally agreed to marry her. On the day that Lucy's body had been found, She had come home from jail and discovered that a wicker suitcase was missing. Berger had admitted that he was responsible. He had taken a prostitute back to the room, and only after lovemaking had admitted that he had no money. He gave the woman the suitcase instead, and to placate Johanna for his infidelity, he had agreed to marry her. The police asked Berger about the suitcase, and he instantly denied knowing anything about it. A few days later, a bargeman handed the case to the police. The stains in the basket proved to be of human blood, and so did certain spots on the floor of Johanna Liebenstrut's room. Berger was charged. What had happened was pieced together at the trial. One day, not long before the murder, Lucy had been in Johanna's room, standing on her head, and Berger had noticed how well-formed her legs were. When Johanna was in prison, Berger became sex-starved. He invited Lucy into the room and attempted indecent assault upon her, but she struggled. He strangled her, raped her, and then dismembered the body and transported it to the river in the wicker suitcase, which he then threw away. Berger was executed. It's an interesting reflection that although the Boston Strangler achieved more notoriety than any other murderer since Jack the Ripper, few people can actually remember his name. Crime experts have always found it puzzling that it is the idea of strangling that seems to have a morbid fascination for the public, rather than the strangler himself.